Meeting will come to order. We'll promote the roll. There is a quorum. Members, we have the minutes of the March 27th meeting of yesterday before us. Representative Carlson moves approval of the minutes. Are there any additions, corrections, changes to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Members, we have three items of business tonight. An amendment to the budget resolution, the omnibus education bill, and then the omnibus transportation bill. I will take up first a proposed amendment to the budget resolution. The chair will move the A8, the RES-01A8 amendment to the budget resolution. And what this does is it increases spending for the education committee by $13 million, takes that money from the $26 million that we have on the bottom line. Then we also, as we have in past years often, we set a target for the healthcare access fund for the different major finance bills, and you can see that on lines 10 through 13. It's primarily a health and human services bill, but there is a little bit of money that we spend out of the healthcare access fund and other bills every year, and we're setting the targets for those along with that. And then we're also proposing to set a target for the basic health plan trust account funds. And what those are the federal funds that we get from the federal government to fund Minnesota Care. So members, really three parts to the A8 amendment to the budget resolution, increasing K-12 by $13 million, setting targets for the health care access fund and the basic health plan trust account. Are there questions on the A8 amendment? Representative Murphy and then Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just two questions about the health care access fund and the basic health plan trust fund. Has this committee in the past set a target for the basic health plan trust fund?
Representative Murphy, I do not believe we have.
And Mr. Chair, what is the purpose of doing that, if you could just explain it for me and for the committee?
Well, I think I might defer to Representative Dean, but I think from my perspective as the author of the amendment, it would just be to say this is the maximum limit on net expenditures that we can do out of the basic health plan so that we don't have changes in taking all those funds and using them for other purposes other than Minnesota Care.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so to the Healthcare Access Fund, have we also done the same cap, if you will, on the Healthcare Access Fund spending in the past?
We have set a target for the Healthcare Access Fund in the past.
And Mr. Chair, does this target include the spending that is going into the reinsurance plan that was negotiated today?
Representative Murphy, these numbers reflect what is in the Health and Human Services bill and the House File 5 as it passed the floor.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. As I understand it, and mostly my information is right now coming from Twitter about the solution on the reinsurance bill, which is really a subsidy to insurance companies. And I understand there's a significant chunk of funding coming from the Healthcare Access Fund that should go to Minnesota Care that is now going to to the insurance companies and premium relief. Is that right? And this target includes that spending.
Representative Murphy, this target includes House File 5 as it passed the House floor. It does not reflect any agreements or alleged agreements that may have been reached in the House File 5 conference committee.
So thanks, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate it. You know, we have had a longstanding commitment and then sometimes disagreements over funding out of the Healthcare Access Fund and its intention. It is supposed to fund the health care that's delivered through the Minnesota Care program, and from time to time, you know, Governor Plenty, for instance, has tapped that for other purposes to balance the budget. It's always made the providers who are contributing to that health care access fund really angry and skeptical about us. So I understand that we're putting a cap on this, but I think it's also important to note and put on the record that there's a pretty significant expenditure coming out of the Healthcare Access Fund for a purpose for which it was not intended. And that's a pretty significant frustration for me and I think for providers across the state of Minnesota.
Well, Representative Murphy, I guess in the interest of full disclosure, I think I should then mention that there was a pretty significant proposal from Governor Dayton to take, if I recall, $700-some million out of the Health Care Access Fund and use it for medical assistance, which is also an expenditure for which it was not complicated. So in full fairness, I guess I feel I should point that out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, we could debate that, and I bet you I could make a pretty persuasive argument about the people who are being covered in medical assistance who were in Minnesota Care. But this is not the Health and Human Services Committee. I just wanted to make sure we put on the record that we're making an expenditure out of the Health Care Access Fund for a purpose for which it was not intended. Thank you.
And I just wanted to put on the record that Governor Dayton has proposed spending several $100 million out of the Health Care Access Fund for a purpose for which it was not intended. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, first of all, I did mention to a couple of your people, at first glance, I thought this amendment was an increase in the targets, but further look at it, found out we were putting caps in place.
Well, it is an increase for some targets.
But it, well, for the K-12.
Right.
Yeah. But I'm talking about the health care access numbers down below, and of course, those then are caps. And I did have questions very similar to Representative Murphy, but I did want to ask, when I look at the handout here, we have a whole column then that, which has changed, $13 million, and then zero. It's the history, and maybe staff can answer this. I'm trying to remember, have we had these kind of gaps on individual accounts in the past? I just don't quite honestly remember. As you pointed out, there have been caps on the Health Care Access Fund, but breaking down the caps then for each one of the items in the budget resolution, is that past practice?
Why don't I call on Mr. Marks and he can answer the question, since he has been here longer than I have. Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, in the Health Care Access Fund, that the budget resolution is structured different ways, but if it's an even-numbered year or an odd-numbered year. In an odd-numbered year, 2009 was a year when we had a budget resolution for the Health Care Access Fund, and it was structured in a similar way to this with caps for each individual area, as well as an overall cap. If it's an even-numbered year, then we're just looking at change from the forecast, and in those years, it's typically not all of these when the health, it's typically one number for Health Care Access Fund when, for Health and Human Services Committee when the Health Care Access Fund has been in the budget resolution.
Okay, so, Mr. Chairman, that's, we get it that time. Have there been other times historically?
Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Carlson, when I was trying to look back on it, I found in 2009 and I believe 2014 were the other years that Health Care Access Fund was part of the budget resolution. I didn't go back any earlier than 2009, so there may have been others.
Split out as it is presented here is what I was referring to. So,
Mr. Chair, yes,
maybe once or maybe twice it's been done this way. Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Representative Weaver.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question really is about the basic health plan trust account. And is that, can you tell me if there are other purposes for which we could be using that fund under federal law? I think that, I'm not entirely sure, but I think that this fund is actually by law required to go only to the basic health plan. Am I correct in that?
Representative Liebling, I think you are correct, but maybe I'll ask Mr. Marks for verification on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, that is correct as I understand it.
Representative Liebling?
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, so that being the case, I just find it really puzzling that you would be putting a cap on money that is in a fund that is for one particular purpose, it can't be spent for anything else, and then saying we're only going to be able to spend this amount of money on that purpose. Is very puzzling to me why you feel the need to do that since we can't spend the money anywhere else.
Well, Representative Liebling, I mean, I guess we can know, we put caps on all the other budget areas for the general fund, and, you know, we could choose to not do that, but both parties, when they've had control, have done that, and so this is just a different fund and a different cap for a different program, but it limits the amount that can be spent in that particular area, just as the other budget targets limit the amount that can be spent in those areas.
Well,
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, since this can only be spent for one purpose and not divvied up like the money that goes to other budget areas, can you give us a little information about why you picked that number? I don't even know how much money there is in that fund at this time.
Sure.
I don't know if we have that in the papers here that are on our desk, but, you know, is that significantly less than the money that's in there? Are you intending to cut back on the number of people who are able to take advantage of the Minnesota Care Program, or exactly what are you trying to do by setting this number where it is?
Representative Liebling, I want to call for some backup verification on this, but I believe that is the forecasted number. But maybe I can call on Chair Dean or Mr. Marks to verify that. Chair Dean?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, the net spending cap is what I believe we have currently projected to spend. Would cap that, and the interpretation, you could say, well, it could only be used for that account. My interpretation is that it could be used for other purposes on the same population. So there may be a little bit of a difference. If you like spending it where it's supposed to be spent on that, if you think that that's the only source, then it would be a good to support the cap. This would not propose doing anything other than just making sure that that money gets spent on that group of people for that program.
Mr. Marks, did you have anything to add?
Mr. Chair, just to verify, it is forecasted that these numbers are from the health care access fund balance from the February forecast as adjusted as the Health and Human Services Committee, and we anticipate is adjusting it. So.
Okay, Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I must say, Mr. Marks, I didn't quite understand that, because we're not talking in this particular line about the Healthcare Access Fund. This is the Basic Health Plan Trust Account, which is different.
I'm sorry, I misspoke. The Basic Health Plan Trust Account was what I was referring to.
Okay, Mr. Chair, could you just repeat the whole thing then, Mr. Marks? It kind of threw me as I was listening to you.
Sure. Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, Representative Liebling. This number is forecasted, and the numbers for the Basic Health Plan Trust Account are from the Health Care Access Fund balance from the February forecast, and then it's adjusted for anticipated committee actions.
Mr. Chair, adjusted for anticipated committee actions. So this is, I assume that this, by putting this number in a budget resolution, this is going to perhaps prevent any changes to Representative Dean's increase of the premiums for people who are on Minnesota Care, or maybe it's going to, if the forecast is on the low side and say we have an economic downturn and more people want to apply for Minnesota Care and become eligible for it, that this would keep them from doing that or something like that. I'm still kind of struggling to figure out what this exactly means. Maybe Mr. Marks can help me with that.
Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, first of all, in the big picture, the budget resolution applies during this session only. It doesn't affect the future forecast or anything like that. It applies to bills as they move through the House this session. So that's the limitation under House Rule 4.03 of the budget resolution. So that's the effect of it.
Yeah, Representative Liebling, I mean, if we had more people show up than had expected to use these funds, I mean, absent us passing some new legislation signed into law that would set a hard cap on how much money we could spend, those people would be taken care of, as they are now.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. Thank you for that, indulging me with that. And just to, so that people understand, too, that these funds that come in for Minnesota Care, these the Basic Health Plan funds, that come from the federal government are based on the cost of insurance in the private, in the individual market. So just so people are aware, if we subsidize those insurance premiums, that may in fact reduce the amount of money that's coming into this fund to pay for Minnesota Care. So there is a, there are interactions here that we need to be aware of as well.
Thank you. Any other questions or discussion? Well, seeing not, I will renew my motion that we adopt the RES 01A8 amendment to the budget resolution. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The A8 amendment to the resolution is adopted. All right. Next item on the agenda is the Omnibus Education Finance Bill. Representative Loon, could you come forward? Representative Loon moves that House File 890 be referred to the General Register. And Representative Loon, do you want to do amendments or do you want to walk through the bill first?
I guess that would be whatever your preference would be, Mr. Chair.
I was going to say it's whatever your preference would be, Madam Chair. Well, why don't we have you just describe the bill and then we'll do the amendments.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, I'll be brief. I'm just going over some of the main points of the bill. House File 890, as amended from we did have an amendment in Tax Committee, provides for a 1.25% increase in general education formula over the 2 years of the biennium. That does include delinking two categorical fundings from that and doing something slightly different with those, the compensatory revenue funds as well as ECFE. They are both delinked and funded differently. And so this equates to about a $76 per student increase in fiscal year 18 and $77 per student increase in fiscal year 19. The compensatory funds, which I mentioned, are delinked. We fund those at $22 million, which is about the same amount as if the compensatory had stayed linked. But we send it out to schools slightly differently. So all schools will receive their compensatory funds according to this $22 million and the number of students qualifying for free and reduced lunch. There will not be a concentration factor included in that, so a student will be a student under this formula. And the funds will be directed to be used for extended time revenue programs to help struggling students. And so that is how the funds will be allocated. Schools will be receiving their money according to a presumption of 95% participation in the MCAs. And for percentage decrease that they are not having student participation in MCAs, there will be a commensurate adjustment to those compensatory funds. Early learning, we do repeal the voluntary pre-K program, which was a pilot program and put into place in the supplemental budget. We're currently in that year, first year of that being done. But for those districts that were part of that pilot, there's 74 currently participating. All those districts will have their VPK, voluntary pre-K money, replaced with school readiness dollars. And that will be a dollar-for-dollar replacement of those funds for fiscal year 18 and a 90% replacement for fiscal year 19. All other school districts not part of that VPK pilot will get an increase in their school readiness dollars, and charters will be eligible for school readiness as well. And that's about $9 million over the biennium. We increase funding for Pathway 1 Early Learning Scholarships, $24.6 million increase. And the ECFE funding, again, that was the other category that we delinked from the formula, would receive an increase of $1 million over the biennium. Let's see. In addition, we also do some coordination of our early childhood funding, creating a director of early education and development that will help to provide greater oversight and coordination of how our early childhood dollars are being spent. As we know, we have several streams of funding. They may be braided and combined. And at this point, we don't really know exactly in how many instances that's happening and how much money we're investing in individual students through our early childhood dollars. Important questions that I think this committee, the Education Committee, and the legislature should know as we look to these important investments and how we continue best providing resources to children who need it most. A couple of other highlights on mental health grants. There's a new initiative to provide $4.9 million in mental health grants to our intermediate districts and to a service cooperative. These are schools that provide services to level four special education students, so sort of our highest need and those with sort of the most, I'd just say our neediest students with regards to special ed. Many of them have suffer from mental illness or have behavioral issues, and so the intermediates have developed a really thoughtful pilot in which we will embed mental health professionals in those schools along with those education professionals working with those students, and I'm very hopeful we'll provide a better model for how those students receive both their education and mental health services. We've had a really disturbing number of incidences of teachers and staff being injured in these schools, and I think it's because they just haven't had adequate mental health and medical professionals to help them with the difficult job that they have. A couple of other things that are in here, Aaron's Law. This is a permissive statute and or an initiative which encourage school districts to incorporate the prevention of child sexual abuse in their health curriculum. And again, just something to help ensure that if schools choose to do this, that they would incorporate it, that into their learning for young children in age-appropriate ways, to know that teachers and the adults in schools are safe people that you could tell if something is happening to you. Lead testing. Representative Fenton introduced a bill this year, and the language similar to that was offered by Representative Thiessen in committee, which would direct the Commissioner of Health and Education to jointly develop a model plan for school districts to accurately and efficiently test for lead in their drinking water. This is something that, you know, we have seen reports on. We do have some incidences of lead in drinking waters in schools, and we certainly want to make sure that our children are safe and that it's being tested and appropriate remediation being taken. Let's see, one last couple of things. We have provided for a dyslexia specialist at the Department of Education. This person would be tasked with helping schools and teachers with professional development for helping students who struggle due to dyslexia. We also would provide an English language arts standards specialist that would provide help to school districts. We know that many of our schools often do not have a curriculum director to help with some of these things, and so additional support for our school districts will be provided through this position. And finally, Purpich Center for the Arts is proposed for the agency is proposed for elimination as part of the bill. Performing Arts School would continue to operate as it currently exists unless some other mechanism is brought forward to continue it in another fashion. So students there would be able to continue their education and graduate through the end of June of 2018. Crosswinds, the Crosswinds School was provided to Purpich a couple of years ago to operate. They have asked that they be divested of that responsibility, and so legislation would provide that Crosswinds would be conveyed to a school district for no less than $10 million, and I have an amendment that it further addresses that issue. So with that, Mr. Chair, that's sort of the highlights of the bill.
Okay. The first amendment we've got then, which addresses some of those issues that Sheridan just talked about, is the A50-4 amendment. Chair Loon moves the A50-4 amendment. And could you describe the amendment, Chair Loon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So, again, I mentioned the Crosswinds School and the language in House Bill 890 that provides that Crosswinds would be conveyed to a school district for no less than $10 million. So that $10 million is built in to the bill before you, but we have provided sort of for a, let's say, best case and worst case scenario with that. So what the amendment does, first of all, is takes the appropriation of $4 million that's in the bill for teacher shortage loan forgiveness programs. It would split that funding of $4 million and divide it between fiscal year 18 and fiscal year 19 amounts. So there would be $800,000 allocated for fiscal year 18, $3.2 million for fiscal year 19. And so this is established so that if Crosswinds is not sold for the second year of the biennium, that $3.2 million in student loans then would not be provided for, or whatever portion commensurate with the sale price. We are also augmenting one-time per pupil aid in the amount, total amount of $6.821 million. So in the second year of the biennium, each pupil fund would be funded at an additional $7.18. Again, for fiscal year 19. And again, this is designed so that if the money's coming in from Crosswinds doesn't total $10 million, then that amount would be adjusted commensurate with the amount that comes in from the conveyance. Two other just sort of language things included. In the supplemental appropriations bill last year, there was appropriated $2.8 million to higher ed. For student teaching grants in shortage areas. However, we have learned that higher ed has not actually provided any of those grants yet, and their concern was that there was no funds for them to use for the development of this grant program and for providing the money out to students doing their student teaching. So we would allow that 2% of the money that was, allocated last year would be used for administrative expenses, with the directive that those grants would go out, begin going out no lower than later than September 1st of 2017. And finally, there's information about an audit trail for the director of the Office of Early Learning, of Early Education and Development. It would just clarify the intent of that audit trail. And so that is the amendment in total, Mr. Chair.
All right. Discussion to the A50-4 amendment. Representative Houseman and Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we did the conveyance of Harambe to the Roseville School District, there was very specific direction given by MMB and others about how exactly that had to be done because of the way the property had initially been funded. And I'm assuming that someone has been in touch with all the relevant departments to make sure that this meets that test. But the reason I'm asking that, and I was just looking for it here and just didn't quite find it quickly, I was thinking that you said something about a sale to either a school district or a nonprofit, but the building would have to be used in the very same way for which it was initially built, I think.
Representative Bloom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will call on nonpartisan staff just as well to make sure that I'm clear on this. Yes, the building, the school was constructed for use as an integration school. And so it's my understanding that conveyance would have to be for that purpose as well. So a school district that would take on the school, they would have to continue to be operated as an integration school.
And
Representative
Hussman, if I just could clarify, and if it was GO bonding, that you couldn't convey that to a nonprofit then, could you? Because it's got, you know, GO bonds would have to be a public entity.
Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hussman, Tim Strom from House Research. Representative Hussman, you're correct on that point about conveying to a nonprofit. As I understand it, finances view, or management and budgets view, rather, has changed a bit since 2013 and 2014. At that time, there seemed to be some strong opinions that conveyance between a school district and a state would perhaps require the 60% bonding vote. the current wisdom that we've received from the Department of Management and Budget is that as long as the use stays the same and the recipient is a public entity, whether the state or a school district, that conveyance does not require the vote total that a bonding bill would otherwise require. That is a different view than what was presented during 2013 when the Harambe and Crosswinds conveyances were first considered. At that time, it seemed to be that there was some strong suggestion that even the conveyance between the school district and the state would require that 60%. But in terms of the nonprofit issue, Mr. Chair and Representative Bloom, I believe the current view is that it would have to be to a state or municipal, essentially, some sort of public entity for it not to require the 60%.
Representative Houseman, did you have another question?
No.
Okay. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, for those of you that are on taxes, you know, I asked several questions about this particular proposal. Part of it has been answered by the amendment. But I did have a couple of others. I was the original author of the integration program, both East and West Metro. And my recollection was that I had carried that legislation in the 890s, and the bonds were probably issued shortly after that or maybe on into the 2000s. The question I had the other day of either Representative Loon or Mr. Strom was, were those bonds retired? Had the debt been paid?
Representative Loon.
Well, Mr. Chair, I will see if Mr. Strom, because I guess I haven't asked you today if we've had an answer, but we have made those inquiries to MMB, and Mr. Strom can offer more detail, but I guess as of when we met in tax committee yesterday, we didn't have that answer, and I don't know if we have it yet.
And Madam
Mr.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, I apologize for not speaking with you earlier today. We did speak with Deb Bass and our office's expert on bonding and learned later this afternoon that essentially the standard that MMB is using is the 125% of the life span, not when the bonds are actually paid. However, their current view is that the full amount essentially would be used then to repay the bonds, but would free up general fund money of the same amount. So the view we've got today, and I apologize for conveying a different message to you yesterday in tax committee, is that the full amount will be available because it will lessen the state general fund payment to repay the rest of the outstanding bonds, and so it won't depend on what portion of the bonds have been paid off. Rather, it's either an all or nothing standard, depending on whether it's within the 125% of useful life. So the transaction, if it were for $1 million or $10 million, that full amount would go to repay the bonds, but would free the state then from needing to pay the $1 million or the $10 million as debt service payment for that same year. So absent some very specific timing issues, it should be a wash on the total money, that if it's $10 million that's raised by the sale, that the state general fund essentially would have $10 million freed up because of that.
Senator, Mr. Chairman, just so I'm clear, if the state has the $10 million freed up, with what you just described, then does that make the money automatically available for this bill?
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, I would defer to the Ways and Means staff. Perhaps Mr. Marks or Mr. Sullivan would like to speak as to how the targets would handle money like that. That's outside of my area, I'm afraid.
Mr. Chairman, it sounds like the state is no longer obligated and the money is freed up, but they built in $10 million in spending here, so I just wanted to make sure that that if the sale were to take place for $10 million or whatever amount, that then with the state dollars being freed up, that the $10 million then is available for use in this bill.
Yeah, Representative Carlson, the bill and the amendment, as I understand it, assume that we do sell the building and that it's structured that we assume we sell it for $10 million. And then there's provisions in the amendment that say, well, if we actually would get more than $10 million, the money goes to a particular area, and if we get less than $10 million, then the money is subtracted from some certain areas so that we can make sure that it does, in fact, balance.
Mr. Chairman, that's what I understand that part of it, but what I'm asking about is the money that's freed up in MNB for debt service because the bonds have been retired. Does that money then somehow have to transfer into the K-12 bill? I think Mr. Marks.
Maybe I'll ask Mr. Marks that question. Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, I think this would be a similar situation to the one we had was 2 years ago, I believe, when we were making changes in the maximum effort loan program and anticipating earlier repayments. Those repayments went into the debt service, would go to the debt service fund as well and require less general fund money for debt service. And that the totality of that in that action was counted in the education finance bill at the time that it was done.
So bottom line, Mr. Chairman, is that the money would be available in this bill.
Yeah, Representative Carlson, Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chair, yes. The action's being done.
Be sitting over an MNB or something. Okay. That's helpful because that was a question I had in the tax committee is where we stood with the debt. Representative Luna, I also asked some questions or made some comments about previous situations. Robbinsdale School District, which I represent, had a conveyance for the Fair School, and there was no charge for that. It was conveyed to the school district. Now we're in a position where another school district then would, if they acquired, have to pay $10 million. Now, in full disclosure, and I forget the exact amount, in the case of the Robbinsdale District, there were some issues in terms of maintenance with the building, and if I recall correctly, the Robbinsdale Schools agreed to take care of that that maintenance, and it's been a while. I think I'm recalling something like $1 million or $1.5 million that was in delayed maintenance. But beyond that, it was basically simply a conveyance to the Robbinsdale School District. In the case of that one, I think all along the Robbinsdale Schools owned the land that the building was built on, but there was the structure itself. So I'm just interested in the philosophy behind charging whatever school district ultimately buys this one, charging one district and conveying it free of charge to other school districts.
Chair Lowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Carlson. Well, I mean, I don't know, I guess, why, or maybe it was contemplated about offering it for a price to those school districts, but as I look at it, it's a reasonably newer school built with state tax dollars through bonding, and the school districts that are currently looking at it see this, I believe, without putting words in their mouth, but just from conversations, they're interested because they have a need for new facilities, and this would be at a much lesser price than going out and building a brand new school.
Yeah, well, Mr. Chairman, I understand that. I'm just talking about the history with conveyance and the fairness. In other words, I hear that St. Paul may be interested, there may be other districts, and St. Paul would be paying $10 million, where other school districts, when there's been a conveyance, didn't have that same obligation. Kind of a question of fairness is what I was raising there, Mr. Chairman. I don't happen to represent St. Paul, but I do look at things from the standpoint of what's fair to, in this case, all school districts, one being charged and others not being or taking over responsibility for the building, I guess, would be the situation with the Fair School. So, Mr. Chairman, I'll stop there, but yeah, I'll just stop there. I've got maybe another question or two on another somewhat related issue.
Okay, and Sherilyn, do you know, I mean, in the previous cases, did we have multiple school districts interested in those schools? Do you know? I'm not sure that we did.
I'm not sure that we did either, Mr. Chair. I know with the Fair School, I think it went to the school district where the building was located. and that's the one in most recent memory before the ones from the East Metro area. Like I said, I guess I don't know why exactly, if there wasn't entertain the idea of actually conveying it for a price. Again, I feel like that's a more responsible approach. Obviously, if we can't get schools interested for a price, that's another story. But there appears to be interest, and it is, again, an economical choice for school districts who are needing additional space than going out and building a new school. So, you know, from a taxpayer standpoint, I think it's at least a responsible way to go about trying to convey the school.
Representative Carlson.
I was just, Mr. Chairman, going to reiterate that in the case of the Fair School, the Robbinsdale schools owned the land that it had been built on. There was an old school there that had been demolished to build the new Fair School. But the Robbinsdale School District retained, if I recall correctly, the land that it was built on. And then generally where it's located, unless a private entity of some sort would have expressed interest, it would have been a pretty difficult location for other school districts to probably utilize it. They probably could have, but there would be some complications in terms of movement of students and so on.
Other questions or discussion? Representative Markworth. Yeah,
thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I guess I can see if this building was going to a private entity that was buying this, but so if it's conveyed to another public school, we're going to give state funds for that school, and that school will use state funds to get the conveyance. Is that correct? So you're kind of taking it from one pocket and giving it to another. I mean, is this assumption correct, or something seems wrong with that?
Well, Dr. Markworth, of course, if we just give them the school, we'll be giving them state funds in the form of a school.
No. Representative Loon?
Well, you know, I think you're right, Mr. Chair. I mean, you know, school districts can use, you know, if they've got, you know, bonding authority available to them, they could use that. There could be a variety of ways they could, you know, come up with the money if they wanted to buy it. Again, it's all I can tell you is that there's interest.
Seeing no further discussion, all in favor of the A48-5 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The A48-5 amendment is adopted. Excuse me, that's the A50-4 amendment. Excuse me, the A50-4 amendment is what we were voting on. I looked at the wrong number. Let me just do that again. All in favor of the A50-4 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion prevails. The A50-4 amendment is adopted. Sorry about that, members. I got ahead of myself. The next amendment is the A48-5 amendment. And the chair will move the A48-5 amendment. And what this amendment does basically is it spends the additional $13 million that was added to the target. It spends it primarily by adjusting funding that goes to school districts for transportation. I've become aware of a number of districts represented by members of both parties that have got significant transportation expenses over and beyond what's covered by our sparsity aid and the other transportation aid that is part of the general fund formula. I've heard of cases, I think the one I heard of that was the worst was up in Representative Eklund's area, where something like, there was a shortfall of something like $490 or so per student in transportation funding in terms of what they were spending money on versus the aid they were getting for that from the state. But this is an issue that's in southern Minnesota, it's all over the state. And I talked to Representative Loon and Mr. Strom about different ways to set up a formula to deal with this. And I think maybe I'd ask Mr. Strom to explain the exact formula that's in the bill or the amendment. Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, members, Tim Strom from House Research. The pupil transportation adjustment is a two-year provision, spends a little over $5.5 million in entitlement each year. And the way the funding works is the district's expenditures for the regular transportation, which is the to and from school daily transportation, those expenditures are added up, and then subtracted from that is the revenue the school district receives for pupil transportation revenue, the transfers in and out for charter school transportation, and then an amount equal to 4.66% of the formula allowance. That money is technically not transportation money. It's part of the general formula. But in the mid-90s, late 90s, when the pupil transportation categorical funding was eliminated, that amount was rolled into the general education formula. That was about $170 per pupil at the time and is now about $250, $260 per pupil now. So those three revenue sources are added together, and then the difference between the district spending when those three categories and its revenue in those three categories is computed, and about half of that, just slightly over half of that amount then, is funded as the amount under this formula. So if a district, for example, had $10 million of spending and $9 million of revenue, the remaining $1 million would be considered its unfunded cost, and half of that would be funded for each of the next 2 years. So, Mr. Chair, that's a very brief description of the formula. I hope to have a printout finished on that available for members in the morning.
All right. And members, in addition to that, there's a couple of other small items in here. Representative Dabney, I guess, in the Education Finance Committee had raised questions about how delinking the non-public transportation aid worked, given that non-public schools and public schools use the same buses, and there were some questions about whether that was workable, and so we added back in money to relink that and the other non-public money that had been in the bill, which is a total of around $2 million in total in this amendment. And then there's some additional money for dealing with the teacher licensure issue in terms of additional funding for the department to the tune of around $700,000. So members, any, any other questions or discussion to the amendment? Representative Houseman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does the reference to transportation sparsity revenue mean this, all the transportation money goes to, Greater Minnesota, or what am I reading in there?
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Luna, Representative Houseman, the current formula is called transportation sparsity revenue. It's based on it uses a couple of different measures, but it's basically the geographic area of the district divided by a modified pupil count. This formula is an adjustment to the overall cost, so there are a number of districts that are within the metro area that receive some aid under this. District doesn't have to be sparse, and in fact, the districts that have come before the K-12 committee in the last several years with an idea similar to this have been districts that tend to have a large population center within them and then a great amount of territory outside of that population center. For example, the Bemidji School Districts and Forest Lake School Districts are examples where there's a fairly big cluster of folks in the town, but the school district is still running buses to all corners of the district. And so the transportation sparsity formula doesn't work very well for them because they've got a fair density. So some of the funding, I haven't had a chance to do a regional analysis yet. My guess is that more of the exurban districts, when the bill came to committee this year, Representative Hoppe was the author. I think the Carver County districts and some of the Isanti districts are ones that benefit fairly substantially from it, as to some of the northern districts that have a large population. It's sort of counterintuitive because those that have a small population but a large area, the current transportation sparsity formula works fairly well for them. So it's really where the sparsity isn't the issue, where the current formula creates this shortfall.
Representative Paulson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm kind of interested in how the geography plays in, and I asked Mr. Strom for some very tentative numbers, and he's just announced that he's going to refine these later. But when you talk about geography, a couple of them, most of them are relatively modest amounts. Important to those school districts, I'm sure, and some amounts probably make the difference between perhaps a beginning teacher or not. Some of them are, relative to the other districts, fairly large amounts. Bemidji at 353, almost 354,000. Now, I assume that's a large, sprawling district when you talk about geography. But then another one that kind of jumps out, I don't know how sprawling it would be. I think it's the largest number on this tentative list, 515,000 for Eastern Carver, where most of them, you know, are 13,000, 16, 15, you know, numbers like that. And then there's Wayzata, which I think is a fairly compact district. It's a fairly large amount, nothing like the 515, but 300 and some thousand, if I recall. And I'm just kind of curious how that formula is working when there seems to be such a swing in the geography, if that's part of the formula.
And Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Luna, Representative Carlson, one of the issues for school districts when they code expenses, they sometimes have choices about how to code those expenses. And so, for example, if a district chooses, it could, in some circumstances, use its integration money for some of its regular to and from transportation if it were part of its intra-district plan. And so what happens when one looks at expenditure data is that it's not entirely clear, since there's no, in general, no formula that currently keys off of it. Some districts may not be coding as much expenditure as they can in that category. It may be in other categories of expenditure of pupil transportation spending. And in other districts, it may be that every single cent is quoted as regular to and from school special pupil transportation spending. There can be some shifting between special ed and not, depending on the circumstances of the district's other transportation needs. And so we've seen the spending jump around from year to year in some districts. And in the amendment, part of the amendment is actually designed to get at that issue by not allowing a district to code more than a certain percent more in any following year to transportation, so that there's not a rush to put expenditures that otherwise wouldn't be coded in there. I can't speak to either the Carver County or the Wayzata situation. Well, we could call the districts in the morning and see if they have a sense of why their transportation may be that way. It may be geographic. For example, in the old transportation formulas, categorical formulas from the 90s that you're probably familiar with, the presence of lakes made a great deal of difference, that even if there was a compact area, if one was driving the bus around various lakes, it was a much longer and more expensive way to do that. And folks used to laugh about the old categorical formula having a factor for lakes. It really didn't, but that was part of what it was designed to get at. So without knowing better, it wouldn't surprise me if some of the geography of the Wayzata School District, maybe the presence of access roads and all that kind of thing, could lead to a more expensive and evolved transportation system than in some other
places. Mr. Chairman, I do remember the old formula did take into even busy highways, railroads, not just lakes, as you commented. I was just curious, you don't need to do any more research on it. I was just curious as to why such a range from what I appeared on the list to be large geographic areas and a fairly compact one. I'm a little bit surprised that UFARS, and I was here when we passed UFARS, was supposed to get at the coding issue so that we would be able to better compare the cost between school districts, and I've just learned that it's still not totally perfect, apparently.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't want to drag this on, and I apologize for using so much of the committee's time on this, but I think it sometimes could be a legitimate situation. For example, if a special ed student were riding a bus that the district otherwise would not have a need to code as special education, but if there were an incentive one way or the other, they might choose to code it as one type of transportation versus another. Is where some of these judgment calls are. I don't think it's an issue that UFARS isn't working so much as that it's a place where a school business official needs to make a call about what transportation service that really was.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's all I need. I don't I'm not requesting any more research, but other than you're going to have a more refined list, if you were going to do that anyway. Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'll send that to the committee first thing in the morning.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Other discussion? Seeing no further discussion, all in favor of the A48-5 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The A48-5 amendment is adopted. Are there other amendments? Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think for the committee, if you look at, when you get the spreadsheet from Mr. Strom, you're going to see that there's 85 school districts in the state of Minnesota that are having deficits in their transportation costs. And this is something I've been working on for several years. I've been throwing different formulas out there and so forth, but if you take a look at the A51 and A52, they're basically the same amendments, and I'd like to address them, then I'm going to withdraw them, because I believe that because of the cost and so forth and leaving some schools out, I didn't want to do that.
But Representative Detmer, do you want to move a particular amendment?
Let's move A51.
Okay, Representative Detmer moves the A51 amendment.
A51 limits the new pupil transportation aid to only those districts who their unfunded cost is greater than $100,000. This allows about 70% of reimbursement rate and spends the same amount of money. So that is the A51 amendment. And I'd like to withdraw that.
All right, Representative Detmer withdraws the A51 amendment. Are there any other amendments?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Detmer.
The A52 amendment.
Representative Detmer was the A52 amendment.
Is the same thing as the A51, except the reimbursement rate raises to 86% of the district qualifies to revenue only if it is unfunded exceeds $200,000. So what I did here with these two amendments is to take a look at the districts that really are having that difficult deficit with their funding for transportation. As I mentioned, there's 85 districts that have deficits in transportation. And if we fully funded all these districts at 100%, it would cost us $34 million. And so what we're looking at, we just approved an amendment that will, you know, put another $11 million in education, and that is at 53.3%. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me to bring these forward. And Chair Loon, I know I've had your ear now for several years, and Mr. Strom, thank you for putting these together for us. I think these 85 districts across the state will benefit from this additional funding. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Detmer withdraws the A52 amendment. Are there other amendments? Okay, I see no other amendments. I understand that Commissioner Casilius would like to testify. Representative Carlson.
I didn't know you were going to testimony, but I just want to make sure that we have on the record we'd like a roll call on the bill.
Okay. There will be a roll call. Commissioner, if you could come forward. Commissioner. Commissioner Casilius, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Brenda Casilius, Commissioner of Education. I won't be able to comment on everything in the bill, but I'd like to bring up some of the highlights, please. I am commenting today on House File 890. In my years as commissioner, I don't think I've seen a bill that's had so much potential for harm to our students, our schools, and our hardworking teachers. I feel an obligation to point out to the committee members just how bad the funding and policy provisions are and how they would undermine the bipartisan work we've been proud of over the past 6 years together. House File 890 claims to increase the formula by 1.25% each year of the biennium. However, if you look closely, those increases are not real increases. That 1.25% relies on shifts from delinking compensatory revenue from our highest poverty schools, our early childhood family education, our non-public pupil aid, which I know you just did some amendments from the general education formula, and cuts to our underrepresented kids and our other critical programming like voluntary pre-kindergarten, pathway to early learning scholarships, which is not included in your district runs, by the way, adult basic education and the support our schools have come to value from the agency and regional centers of excellence. After receiving detailed financial figures showing deep cuts to many districts, the bill was amended to delay some of the fiscal impact of the immediate elimination of voluntary pre-kindergarten funds to districts already running their programs. This change not only cuts into the already insufficient formula increase to all districts, it also shifts the pre-K dollars to school readiness funding that's then zeroed out in just 2 years. That is a double whammy with your Pathway 2 scholarships elimination and the VPK elimination. I encourage everybody to look at new district runs with your Pathway 2 cuts. This proposal pushes 3,300 four-year-olds out of pre-kindergarten programs that our schools have invested in and forces thousands of future families to pay out of pocket for high-quality preschool. It also ignores the 13,800 children currently waiting for voluntary pre-kindergarten that would be funded under the governor's budget. If we value parent choice, it would make more sense to support a program parents are demanding and provide pre-K in over 269 of our districts and charters and every county of this state, rather than overfunding our scholarship program, which we support, that currently has a waiting list of just 821 students, children. And it would only take $12 million to cover those 821 children currently waiting for a scholarship. I want to remind the committee that the governor also provides in other parts of his budget for a child care tax credit and also $84 million for the child care program through the DHS budget. I want to mention that our American Indian kids at our tribal schools deserve an equal education. They currently receive the same amount for their education on average as any other Minnesota student, thanks to bipartisan efforts 2 years ago. But House File 890 rolls back that progress, and it delivers a significant blow to our efforts to improve outcomes and graduation rates for American Indian kids. Some of the graduation rates are the lowest in the nation, and these kids deserve our attention. House File 890 leaves out crucial supports for many essential services. There's zero funding to increase the amount of student support to staff in schools. When we know Minnesota has one of the worst counselor-to-student ratios in the country, additionally, the bill provides no change in funding for special education services, which we know is growing. That's 15% of our students. As our schools struggle to cover the increasing costs that are unfunded by the federal government, House File 890 undermines the state capacity to support our schools and families through cuts to the Minnesota Department of Education. The refusal to include the governor's recommendation to maintain MDE's current capacity due to rising employee and contract costs and IT costs on top of the bills cut to the agency, this will result in a 13.5% reduction to the department. This will result in the elimination of 23 full-time employees, including the School Safety Technical Assistance Center, which helped more than 200 families address incidences of bullying last year. The bill also cuts the regional centers of excellence, whose staff work with leadership teams at 118 low-performing schools, providing crucial tools to improve academic achievement across the state. These cuts will have real and devastating impacts. Additionally, the bill, as amended, undercuts the department's ability to implement the Minnesota State Plan for the Every Student Succeeds Act. The bill would require legislative approval before implementing our state ESSA plan. However, states are required to submit the plan to the U.S. Department of Education no later than September 18th. And by law, the U.S. Department of Education must inform states within 120 days if the plan is approved. If approved, the U.S. Department of Education is expecting the state to implement the plan as submitted in order to receive the federal funds tied to ESSA. If the Minnesota legislature does not approve the plan in a timely manner, it jeopardizes over $230 million in federal funds that goes to serve our low-income students. Furthermore, in dictating what the ESSA plan should look like, the amendment mandates which data would be reported in our state plan. However, some of these data are not even currently available. This represents an unfunded mandate to schools to collect new data. Adopted in committee with no public testimony, this provision completely undermines the stakeholder engagement central to the federal law and is inconsistent with the input we've heard from stakeholders across Minnesota in more than 150 meetings over the course of the past year. I have a map that shows everywhere that we've been with our stakeholder engagement, as well as 7 pages of meetings with the public and them telling us and listening, and us listening to what they want to have into the bill or into the plan. Finally, the governor does not support closing Perfect School and really was hoping for a clean budget bill that he could sign and negotiate. I am saddened for the message that House File 890 sends to our kids, our families, and our teachers, a message saying that at a time in which the state has a $1.6 billion surplus, it is preferable to cut resources to poor schools and students. I encourage you to go back to the drawing board to create a bill that values our children and the future. As I said in my testimony before the House Education Finance Committee last week, I oppose this bill in the strongest possible terms. I believe it is insufficient in terms of providing the resources our students and schools need to be successful, and worse, has the potential to do serious harm to students and to schools. Thank you.
I don't see any questions. Thank you, Commissioner Casillas. Casillas. With that, we'll move to the bill. Representative Markport.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I have a couple areas here. Chair Loon, on the compensatory part again, where you're delinking that, I think you mentioned that it'd be like a $22 million deficit that you're covering with some funding. Is that, or did I misunderstand it? How are you making up for that? I heard the $22 million. Is that like a one-time, or is that ongoing, or how does that work?
Representative Loon.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Markport, members. So the $22 million is representative of the amount, if compensatory stayed linked, what would float up in that categorical with a 1.25% is about $22 million. And so we take that money, same amount of money, but we're going to distribute it to school districts according to their compensatory students, their students who qualify for free and reduced price lunch, slightly differently. So again, the money will go out to according to those numbers of students that they have, and again, full count for free lunch and a half count for reduced price lunch. That's our current way the money goes out. There would not be additional money for the, quote, concentration factor now. So, again, the money would just be allocated according to those pupils. And then the money is to be spent by school districts in extended time programs. So additional programming for those students. It can be after school, summer school. Some school districts do what they call academies, like spring break academies, winter break academies. There's a fair amount of latitude to the school districts and how they can structure these programs. But again, as a tool to try to close the achievement or the opportunity gap, you know, it's hard to latch on to one thing that will help. But we do know from research that additional time for those students who struggle does make a difference. It does show up in a difference. And so that is sort of the purpose behind how we're restructuring this compensatory funding.
Representative Markport.
Thank you, Chair Loon. So let's say into 2021, let's just assume there was, you know, a 1% increase each of the next, into those years, let's say, on the basic formula, how would the compensatory work there? Is there, let's say it's another $22 million that would have been there had it not been delinked. Is there another $22 million that covers, or does that have to be reauthorized back in, let's say, into the future, 20 and 21?
Chair Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just looking at my spreadsheet to make sure I don't tell you wrong. It would be continued into the tails. So that would continue, again, according to, obviously, you know, the formula funding is for 18, 19. And, again, if it would continue with that policy unless, there, you know, when the next budget is done, if that's adjusted.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that's my question is, you know, So it's okay. I mean, you're covering the $22 million in this time around. And I mean, so is it in, and I haven't looked close enough, is it matched then with the formula later on that this extra dollars that would have been there but for, you know, whether or not it's a 1 and a 1 or a 2 and 2 and a 20 and 21, do you have those extra dollars there? Or is the compensatory, because it's delinked, going to be flat unless we act specifically when we raise the general ed formula, we have to come back again? Or is it frozen?
Yeah.
Representative Bloom.
Mr. Chair, it is permanent delinked, and I want to just confirm that. Yes, we permanently delinked it, so there would have to be language addressing exactly what would happen with compensatory revenue when the next budget is done in two more years.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, I mean, that's my concern, is that the compensatory basic skills revenue was set up, and there's a proxy there, and it's free and reduced meal, because we know probably the number one demographic factor in the achievement gap is the poverty. And so now when it's not linked, this number could potentially, theoretically, be frozen, the compensatory. So as we raise the general ed levy, that stays the same, and that's the portion of the funding that we have talked about as a state that is targeted, because we know not all school districts are created equal. And so that was set up to try to get to those most concentrated areas. And I like the extended time, but what really concerns me is this fact that it's basically frozen unless we come back. So it's not automatic anymore when we raise the formula. We got to come back and also raise that portion, and we know how difficult it is as we look at these budgets to do that. So that's my real concern, because that's kind of the one pot of money, one of the major ones that we have set up as a proxy to get to those schools that have the greatest poverty and trying to close the achievement gap. So that's one concern. On the voluntary pre-K versus the school readiness, they're different programs. And the voluntary pre-K does not allow the school to do any fees to parents. Under this new money that's coming in to replace the voluntary pre-K, I know under school readiness, schools must set up a sliding fee schedule based on income. So my question is, now under the school readiness, will schools be allowed to charge fees to parents under the new dollars coming in?
Chair Long.
Mr. Chair, Representative Marquardt, yes, schools would be able to set up their sliding fees under the school readiness statute. I also know from testimony on this before our committee that some schools don't charge a sliding fee to parents regardless of income in their school readiness program. So the schools do have some latitude there. I would say, for one thing, the reason I like this approach better is that there is more flexibility for the schools in their school readiness dollars. Second of all, with the VPK, and this is, you know, I've been trying to get more data on this. There's about 3,300 students served. How many students were being served in some other program that we fund in early childhood of those 3,300 students? We don't have that information. We did hear some testimony that indicates to me one school district that provided information that probably two-thirds of their VPK students were already being served under school readiness, and they were moved over. But what we do know is that approximately 78% of the students in VPK from those pilot sites qualify for free and reduced lunch, and that's sort of the standard that we set for qualifying for an early learning scholarship. 22% are not. And as we try to reach as many students economically disadvantaged as we can, I think it's important that we look to how we do that. And being able to charge some kind of tuition to parents of greater means, I think, is an option that schools should have.
Thank you. Just one more. Well, that does concern me, because, Mr. Chair, we are moving from a program that at no fees, still, there's going to be more out-of-pocket expenses.
So no fees regardless of income level.
Right. The last area that I have is on the pathway two. And so in the bill it says it eliminates that. When does that start in the next school year, 17-18 coming up, or when does that take effect?
Chair Lynn.
Mr. Chair, it would be keyed with the start of this budget cycle.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Marquardt.
So if a school had 10 slots this year, which means they're getting 10 times $75,000, next year they would be getting nothing?
Mr. Chair.
Chair Lynn.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, and Representative Marquardt, so we have our scholarship dollars, as you know, are split in half. And so half are Pathway 1, and that is money that goes to parents to make a choice about a quality provider. It may be school. It may be a daycare center with a preschool program. It may be a home-based provider. As long as they're quality rated, they are options a parent can choose with a scholarship. Pathway 2, which is the other half, goes to programs. And in that Pathway 2 requirement, there is not a set number of students that must be served for those Pathway 2 dollars. It can be used to serve additional students. It can be used to add hours to a student that's being served for maybe another half day. It can be used for professional development of staff, training, other program enhancements. So unlike the Pathway 1 dollars, which goes specifically for a student to participate in a program, Pathway 2 does a multiple number of things, but it goes directly to programs. And I know that school districts are concerned about this because 67% of the Pathway 2 money goes directly to their programs. What I'm trying to do is restore us to sort of the vision, if you will, of what we're doing in early learning by empowering parents, having the money go directly to parents through their scholarships, and they can choose the program that works best for them. In Pathway 2, if a parent goes to a school district and gets into a program under Pathway 2, if, say, the parent has a job transfer or needs to move to another community for some reason, maybe their housing is no longer in that community, that Pathway 2 scholarship does not follow that child to where the family moves. That student loses their scholarship. And that is always something that's been of great concern to me, because under Pathway 1, that is portable. And that follows, that child is awarded a scholarship. That scholarship goes with that child if the family needs to relocate. Again, trying to keep sort of the integrity of the program in that it follows the child and that the parents are empowered to make that choice.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Marquardt.
And I hate to belabor this, but this is important. I mean, I think we're actually reducing options for parents when you take away Pathway 2 and you take away the voluntary pre-K. I mean, why not keep those as choices? I understand what you're saying, but to me you're eliminating that, and it's these other options may cost more money, but in terms of school funding, you know, and I know the spreadsheet that was passed out yesterday in tax committee doesn't have this on there, but the minimum slots that a school received were 5. And at $7,500, that's $37,500 a school. Many of them have 10 slots, which is $75,000. And when I was looking at the per pupil funding increase, it's an average of about $100 per pupil, which means if you were getting 10 slots, $75,000, and you're only getting $100 here, if you have 750 students, you're losing $100 per pupil, which means if you have 750 or less students in your school and you had a Pathway 2 program and you're losing it, you're actually going backwards in this budget bill. And there are almost 300 schools that had the Pathway 2 funding, 100 Head Starts, about 120 child care centers that had the Pathway 2. And I don't know, Mr. Strom, if you could put that on the spreadsheet, but I think members should see that. Because I'm using one for example here, District 402 Hendricks. And they had an increase of $108 in base change in 18, and they had a program. They lost $75,000. They will lose. That's a loss of $657. There are 114 pupils. So they're losing $657 per pupil, and their net with that, and their net loss under this proposal with the one and a quarter, they're going to lose about $550 per pupil, about a 4.4% of their revenue. And now, I first of all, Mr. Chair, I want to see if, am I correct here? I mean, am I reading this right? And I don't know who can answer that, but if I'm off base, tell me. I'm just kind of figuring this as I was thinking about it. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative
Mr. Strom.
I think the issue on the printouts is the baseline does not include the early learning scholarships, nor does the alternative, which is a bit of a separate question from what you're asking. As Representative Loon said, there'd have to be some judgment about how many parents would choose under Pathway 1 to go to a school program to make a list like that. We'll see what we could put together in terms of the raw numbers of dollars by district, Pathway 2 dollars by district, but I think there would still need, in order to get from there to a predicted level of spending, there'd have to be some sort of guesstimate about whether schools would close those programs or whether, if they remained an option, how many parents would choose them.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And yeah, I think it was important to clarify. So the VPK money has been restored to those districts, and I'll come back to that in a moment. The Pathway 2 money, there's no set amount for Pathway 2. That is not, that is an annual basis that that Pathway 2 money is awarded. It's not like part of that program's base, as I understand it. And it's also not provided in a set amount per pupil. Unlike the early learning scholarships, which have a cap, if you will, set by the commissioner at $7,500, Pathway 2 is not funded in that same way to those programs. So there's no specific number of students allocated to that Pathway 2 money. For instance, if they have 10 students on their waiting list, that they have to take all 10 students on their waiting list with the Pathway 2 money that they receive.
Mr. Chair, my last point then, I just think members need to look at that and ask their districts, because if in fact you have 10 slots, $75,000 to a district of even 200 to 300 students, losing those dollars will be significant. And I know it doesn't show up here, but that early child area, I think we're reducing the amount of options. I think we're going to create more out-of-pocket expenses for parents. And I think districts, with this current scenario, could be losing funding, literally, with this huge surplus, could be losing funding when you take all of this into consideration. And so I'll leave it at that, but I think it really is a concern, because that Pathway 2 funding, or dollars that go to program, go to the school. So that could be lost.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I share Commissioner Casilius's strong concerns about this and overall in the bill, but I wanted to particularly express reservations about how compensatory revenue is handled and this delinking to the formula. And in particular, and we haven't talked about it yet, I wanted to call attention to Subdivision 5 in Section 13, which is on page 12. And that's scaling the participation rate for comprehensive assessments, the MCA, to the compensatory revenue. So basically what we're doing here is we're saying to parents that if you want your child to opt out of this test, your district could be penalized. And I just think that sends the wrong message. I think it really overemphasizes the importance of standardized testing, which again, many parents and educators have concerns about, particularly the MCAs. And to somehow link this to funding is very wrong. And so of the many things that I object to in this bill, this is one that I particularly object to, and I wanted to call attention to it, Mr. Chair. And I think overall, this delinking to the formula does impact the highest poverty districts, including Minneapolis, where I represent, and others around the state, both in the urban and greater Minnesota. So for that reason and many others, I'll be voting no.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I was planning on just making a few wrap-up comments, and I listened to the commissioner, and I checked off the things I had on my list, so I won't repeat what she said, but a lot of my concerns were virtually identical in many, many areas that she presented to the committee. But so I decided to maybe take a slightly different track and, you know, remind committee members that we advocated on our side the aisle last Thursday a more balanced approach to the budget. And as I sit here and I listen to the commissioner and I looked at the notes that I had, there's no reason that we should be not continuing to invest in education, both our children and our students. And that's just not happening under this particular budget, and it's pretty glaring in this bill. And one of the reasons at this state, and we debate, you know, business climate and what have you, but the bottom line is that most of the business community, most of the parents would tell you that the best investment that we can make in the state of Minnesota is in education, whether we're calling about or talking about the early through grade 12 bill, or if we're talking about the higher education bill and some of the things that go into that, like the research and so on. And so we're just grossly underfunding other parts of the state budget and putting a particularly large target into the tax bill. And that's creating the problems that we're hearing about here tonight. And I would just hope, as this bill moves forward and you're in the majority, and I'm sure you'll move it forward, that when targets are set in the conference committee, that some what I'll call basic reason begins to prevail. You know, the state of Minnesota has slipped. We were at one time the top three, maybe number one, but it's clearly in the top three a few years ago in terms of our investment in early ed K-12. And now I think we're down kind of close to the middle of the pack. I think the last time I looked, we were number 15 in the country. So we're slipping, and I don't think that holds well for the future of the state of Minnesota. I did want to comment a little bit on the compensatory. You know, I'm a retired teacher, and I taught in school sites that were fairly affluent. I also taught in a very high poverty school, 66% free and reduced lunch. In the school district I represent, I've visited a number of the schools, and some of them have, and it's a suburban district, high incidences of poverty. And let me tell you that that concentration part of the formula is vitally important in terms of delivering an educational opportunity for those children in those high poverty schools. And those of us that represent suburban school districts, especially districts that are inner suburban, are seeing those changes firsthand almost year by year in terms of the greater needs as the incidence of poverty based on free and reduced lunch and so on becomes a greater and greater part of the school district, and we've got to address those needs. And this bill goes, in my view, in the wrong direction when we use the approach where it goes out per pupil. And so, Mr. Chairman, as I mentioned earlier, I would encourage a roll call vote, and hopefully reason will prevail in the next few weeks so that we do right by our children and students across the state of Minnesota.
And Representative Carlson, there will be a roll call vote, and I will just briefly remind members that this budget proposal in Sherilyn's bill does increase funding by over $1.1 billion from the last biennium, which is roughly a 6.5% increase biennium to biennium. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I have not ever heard such compelling testimony as I heard today by the Commissioner of Education. I previously served on the Education Committee just one biennium. But, members, I represent one of those districts that have a high concentration of poverty that will be directly harmed by the delinking of the concentration in the compensatory funding. My school district has been very creative, and we have one of the districts has formed The all-inclusive school that we heard testimony about, the Brooklyn Center School District, they now have a health clinic at the school. They now have access for the students to get what they need at the school. And this bill will harm them. I'm incredibly troubled when a commissioner says that we should go back to the drawing board and create a bill that values our children and their future, and that this bill doesn't do that. You can put money in a bill, and you can say that you increase the funding, but when you redistribute the funds in such a way that you are actually harming our youngest learners and our poorest learners, I think it really is, it no longer reflects our shared values here at the Minnesota Legislature. So I'm a no on this proposal. I think it says something about our society and the way we treat our youngest and our oldest. And so far we've made a choice, you've all made a choice here at the legislature, to give one of the largest tax cut bills that I've ever seen and shortchange our youngest learners here.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The 2015 tax cut bill is over $2.2 billion.
Chair Loon, closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. Well, I mean, clearly there's a difference of opinion on the bill, and, you know, I'll leave aside the amount of money, but I just wanted to talk a little bit about what I think is spurring probably a great deal of the comments from the commissioner in that, and it's surrounding the early childhood area. And clearly, we just have a difference of opinion on how best to provide quality early learning experiences for those students who need it most, those that would follow into the achievement or the opportunity gap. And, you know, some years ago, the state embarked down a pathway, a model that is really being emulated and copied by other states across the nation. They call it the Minnesota model. And it is a mixed delivery system of quality programs, whether it be school-based, maybe a preschool in your local church that's operated, a center-based childcare center that's got a great preschool curriculum embedded in it, a home-based provider that's the same, all quality rated. And the concept was, we will empower parents who can't afford these quality options for their children, and we will give them a scholarship to make a choice. And this is something that was research-driven, it was data-driven and tested, piloted. Our own business community put millions of dollars of their own money, no taxpayer money, into that, piloting that concept, Minnesota Early Learning Foundation, many years ago. And from that was born this mixed delivery system. Now, the governor has now wants to chart a course with a new program. It was called Universal Preschool a couple of years ago. It's now called Voluntary Preschool, but it's the same concept, only rolled out slower. It's a grade four-year-old at all of our public schools. And while I don't take anything from the governor in his intentions, I think they are good. I share the same intention in terms of trying to reach all the children that we can. But the approach we have here is more targeted in terms of devoting resources first to those children who need it most. And secondly, and I think perhaps even more importantly, it empowers parents. We are ensuring choice. We are choosing to fund specifically children and families over programs. And that is not to take away from any program or the good things that are done in our schools. It is, again, preserving that important choice for these parents of young children. So while we may disagree on the approach with the money provided in the target that we had to work with, we do increase our early learning funding $31.1 million over base, 20% increase in early learning scholarships, and an increase 14% increase in school readiness, and that's not counting the school readiness money that replaces the VPK money. That's the additional money over base for those other districts. So, You know, I appreciate the concerns and comments of my colleagues. I do listen to suggestions, and we've made a number of changes in the bill as it's gone along. I expect we'll continue to make more as we move on to the next steps and into conference. But, again, I think we are prioritizing the right thing. We're prioritizing kids. We're prioritizing parent choice. We are trying to allocate to those students who need it most.
With that, Representative Loon renews her motion that House Bill 890, as amended, be referred to the General Register and that staff make technical corrections as needed to the bill. The clerk will take the roll on the bill.
Representative Nava?
Aye.
Representative Vogel?
Yes.
Representative Carlson?
No.
Representative Anderson?
Yes.
Representative Baker?
Yes.
Representative Cornish?
Aye.
Representative Davids?
Yes.
Representative Dean?
Yep.
Representative Detmer?
Yes.
Representative Drazkowski?
Aye.
Representative Fabian?
Aye.
Representative Garofalo?
Yes.
Representative Gunther?
Yes.
Representative Hamilton?
Yes.
Representative Hausman?
No.
Representative Hillstrom?
No.
Representative Hornstein?
No.
Representative Liebling?
No.
Representative Loon?
Yes.
Representative Marquardt?
No.
Representative Murphy?
No.
Representative Mornis?
Yes.
Representative Pawlowski?
No.
Representative Poppy?
No.
Representative Torkelson?
Aye.
Okay. Representative Erdahl?
Let's see. Yes.
Representative Wagenius.
There being 17 ayes and 9 nays, the motion prevails, and House Bill 890, as amended, is referred to the General Register. Members of the committee, at this time I'm going to call a temporary recess until 9:20, at which time I anticipate returning to take up the transportation bill. We are in recess.
I think we can do that one a lot faster. my ideas. If I don't get there by the end of May, Put my leg in it. And my heel is elevated. There's a strand of fire. And I stood on the first floor. And I
Good evening. I'm going to reconvene the meeting. Members, the next item of business before us is House File 861. The Omnibus Transportation Bill. Representative Torkelson moves that House File 861 be referred to the General Register. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have an amendment. Would you like to deal with that first, or do you want me to present the bill?
Why don't you deal with that one first? Representative Torkelson moves the A-17-0313 amendment. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you. This amendment removes some language that was added in the tax committee. The effects of that language were not entirely clear when it was adopted, and it's just best if we remove this from the bill, Mr. Chair.
And members, this is the language relating to paying a higher price for commercial appraisals, and I guess as it was further investigated, I think that this applied to more units of government and maybe had a larger fiscal cost than was anticipated. Are there any questions on the 0313 amendment? See no questions. All in favor of the A-17-0313 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Torkelson, could you present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 861 and Senator Grossman is a substantial bill to address the transportation needs of the state of Minnesota. We do this with a significant amount of spending. First in the first biennium is over $2 billion, $2.1 billion, and over the 10-year life of the, over the 10-year period, as this bill recommends a variety of spending, it totals $6 billion invested in our transportation system here in the state of Minnesota. We do this without raising taxes, without raising the gas tax. Instead, we are capturing sales tax revenue on the sale of auto parts, rental car tax, and motor vehicle lease tax. Those revenues, the new revenues, total $450 million. That is not 100% of those estimated revenues, but it does meet our target. We gather those funds into what we are calling a Transportation Priorities Fund, and from there we distribute them to the various needs within the transportation budget. We do also hold the Met Council harmless by limiting the growth of their budget to its current level, and that is accomplished by taking away some of their general fund allocations as their MVES revenues, Minnesota Vehicle Sales Tax revenues, rise. We actually reduce their general fund allocation to the point that their funding from the state is held steady. We also require CTIB to pay for transit operating costs instead of the state of Minnesota. We do have language in this bill that addresses efficiencies. We expect 15% efficiencies from the Department of Transportation, and they've agreed that they can do that, but we do not book that as a number on the spreadsheet. As a result of this bill, it'll be $428 million in 18-19 of additional funds into the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. And the total revenues, as I mentioned earlier, is $450 million over the biennium from sales tax revenues.
We also approach bonding as a source of funds for building roads. We have $250 million a year for 4 years of authorized trunk highway bonds. The difference here is that these trunk highway bonds will be actually serviced by the general fund revenue from the sales tax dollars. The reason for doing that is that we can do additional bonding without approaching the 20% guidance that's part of the department's language, where they try to keep their bonding to below that threshold, and we can do this, service these bonds with general funds and not affect the threshold with those. There is $300 million of corridors of commerce bonding, and those are trunk highway bonds in the first year of the biennium. We are also making suggestions to the Capital Investment Committee that they do $200 million a year in general obligation bonding in the 4 years of the cap, first 4 years, and ongoing through the 10 years, actually. And also we do recommend significant bonding to fund rail grade crossings of $35 million a year. There are major differences, as I expressed earlier, from the governor's plans that we are not increasing gas tax, we are not increasing tab fees. We are, however, eliminating the MnDOT passenger rail office, and there are another number of other provisions within the bill, such as license plates for law enforcement memorial license plates, and start seeing motorcycle license plates. There are some memorial bridges and roads that we have identified through the committee process. We do fund a pilot program for suburb-to-suburb transit, commonly known as the 494 Transit Project. There is also an increase in funding for the State Trooper Training Academy. Those candidates for a State Trooper that take part in the Academy will be funded at 100% of their salary level in the second portion of the Academy, and 80% of that level in the first portion of the Academy. We are funding a helicopter for the Highway Patrol. They have three helicopters now, one of which I think last report actually all three were temporarily grounded. One is, I believe, permanently grounded, another not quite so permanently grounded, and the third one just recently had an error code come up. But they would reduce their fleet to two helicopters with the addition of this new helicopter that we are recommending funding for. With that, Mr. Chair, those are the highlights of the bill. Given the late hour, I will refrain from too much detail, but I would be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Chair Torkelson. Are there any other amendments to the bill? All right, discussion to the bill. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make a couple of brief comments. I would urge a no vote. The issue of taking general fund money to fund the roads and bridge needs in this bill is ill-conceived. The contractors that came to our committee spoke repeatedly of the fact that they need stable, reliable, dedicated funding. And we have that in Minnesota, constitutionally dedicated funding. And to deviate from that at this point is not going to solve this problem. And in fact, it's going to exacerbate pressures on the general fund. So when we take money from schools, from senior citizens, from nursing homes, and other priorities, and instead of using our dedicated sources, we will run the risk of losing this money the first time we have a problem with our economy and a deficit. And so that's what happened in Wisconsin. They used general fund money and had a deficit, and boom, they took it right out of the transportation fund to fund other things. So that's what we're setting ourselves up for. Secondly, there are deep transit cuts. I would disagree with the chairman that this does not hold the Met Council harmless. In fact, there's a $122 million cut. That's going to result in a 40% reduction in regular route bus service. We've heard a lot from the other side about how they like buses, they don't like trains, but this really eviscerates the local bus service. And we also don't fund very important bipartisan
bus rapid transit lines, for example, the one that goes from Minneapolis to Lakeville, the Orange Line, and St. Paul to Woodbury, which is the Gold Line. The chairman mentioned rail safety, and I appreciated that Chair Torkelson and I pretty much introduced similar bills related to rail safety earlier in the session, trying to make sure that we have better communication between first responders and the railroads. Those bills didn't get heard, but a bill that absolved railroads of liability in light rail corridors was fast-tracked, and unfortunately that's in the bill. That runs the risk of taxpayers paying the costs of a serious rail incident, a spill or an explosion in a light rail corridor. I think that's very troubling and problematic. This also falls short in terms of expectations the Department of Public Safety has in terms of the governor's recommendations and priorities. So for all those reasons and more, Mr. Chair, I would recommend a no vote.
Representative Halston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was hoping, and we were, when we borrow in this nature, I usually like to have a little comfort level of having looked out further than, and I think we heard the from Mr. Lee, the 4 years out, and each year it was dramatically higher, and it would have just been helpful to get the chart that showed that all, but I think maybe PennDOT wasn't able to get that together. So that's a little bit of an unknown. I wish we could still get that before this reaches the floor. I don't know how soon that's going to happen. The part that I want to talk about and remind everyone about, we had amazing testimony on this from the business community who tried to paint a different picture about what you need to do in a city to keep a region economically competitive. But I was struck most by the writers, and one gentleman in particular who said he wasn't going to write his testimony down because he didn't want to read it because he wanted to look us in the eye. And he was mostly bewildered because he realized we were not cutting Greater Minnesota Transit. They were getting extra funding. We were not cutting the Suburban Transit Association. They were getting additional. Only this segment of the transit system was going to be cut. And he couldn't understand what was the reason. And he looked at us and said, is there an answer for that? Can someone explain this to me? Because these are the people who use it to get to work. It keeps them moving and going and living and being part of this vibrant and competitive economy here. So whether it was from the riders or from the business community and local government officials, there is a confusion about what we're trying to accomplish with this really unprecedented backward step in terms of public mass transit. In a city, the only way you prepare for another 800,000 people is you have to move masses of people in some corridors. That's what public mass transit is, moving masses of people in some corridors. And you do that carefully. You choose the corridors carefully. You choose the mode carefully. None of that is done in any kind of haphazard way. And to see that dismantled, I feel some of that same bewilderment that the riders feel. And I hope at some point, I know, Mr. Chair, you are the author of the bill right now, not the chair, that you've suggested maybe we're still, you know, this is an ongoing process. I hope that's the case, that we're still looking at this bill and having some conversation about it. But that's the most painful part of the bill for me.
Representative Torkelson, closing comments.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. As I said earlier, this is a substantial bill that is a big step forward in addressing transportation funding in the state of Minnesota, and I ask for your support.
Seeing no further discussion, Chair Torkelson renews his motion that House File 861, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. House File 861, as amended, is referred to the General Register. Members, tomorrow, I will announce the time that we're meeting on the floor. We will be taking up the public safety bill, the legacy bill, I will say the agriculture bill, although I got to talk to Representative Hamilton about it one more time, and possibly the higher ed bill. The ag bill would be an addition to what we have on the scheduled agenda. Questions, Representative Carlson.
Yeah, I thought you posted the higher ed bill.
I did.
One of the memos. So that's a change then, or?
It's still on the agenda.
Well, your comment just now, just clarify that very quickly. You said you may take up the higher ed bill or you may not?
Both. All right, we're putting it on the agenda, Representative Carlson.
And you plan on taking it up?
Mr.
Chairman, is that the Democrats will be meeting, and I want to know if we should talk about the bill then tomorrow.
I guess I would talk about it, Representative Carlson.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Yep. Any other questions? All right, members, thank you. Meeting's adjourned. Good night.